It's the Poison Pastor edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Sending the Queen Down the River, Snake Bites Pastor, Guilty Dogs, and the last segment with Seth Klein about inequality. Let's begin episode 169.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ian, this week, I heard there was supposed to be a 1,000-strong Queen Flotilla heading down the Thames River in London this weekend. I have to tell you the truth, I was a little disappointed. I didn't see Elton John, Ian McKinnon, Stephen Fry, not a single queen to be had. Well, I mean, they did have this old bird, but I mean, she doesn't have the same style the other ones have.
Thank you.
I'm here all week.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm hinting at what?
The Diamond Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II. And, you know, it probably won't be a surprise to, alert listeners that I have some strong feelings about the sort of overwhelming coverage that this old woman has gotten for the amazing feat of living.
Well, if people who don't know, because you're not in the studio, Ian right now is completely dressed in the royal regalia. He's wearing a British T-shirt. He has a little hat that says, I love the Queen. And his underwear, well, I don't know what that is, but I'm sure it's Queen related. No, Ethan, you seem to be a bit not monarchy.
Not monarchy, to say the least. You know, I mean, I understand that for some people, the monarchy represents kind of this tradition and sort of a cultural institution, which is, I think, fine for, you know, British people. I don't quite understand why Canadians are expected to sort of embrace this, you know, centuries-old tradition that really actually hasn't benefited our nation all that much. What I find kind of frustrating, though, is that in all the coverage that I've seen on, you know, the CBC and CTV and all the different news channels, I haven't really seen any coverage of the sort of other side of this question. That is, why is our government and the British government and all the other governments spending all this money, putting on these lavish parades and parties for what is essentially a institution that kind of represents some of the worst forms of government ever devised by human beings. And again, to sort of foist it on a person whose only contribution was being born into this system. And I mean, the amazing thing, of course, is that if this was a few centuries earlier, it's unlikely that the Queen would have reached her Diamond Jubilee, because more likely she would have been assassinated by her own family members to steal the throne. So I guess in that respect, we can congratulate her.
Well, okay. So I'm going to play devil's advocate here. So there's not going to be any fighting in the studio, although if you do hear bloodshed, it wasn't by me. So first of all, Ethan, your last statement about being assassinated. When was the last time a royal monarch, British royal monarch, because we are talking perhaps a bad institution, royalty, but people will claim this is the cream of the crop for that. When was the last time a royal was assassinated and deposed in that sense? I mean, you might say...
The obvious one was Princess Diana. I kid. That was not an assassination.
That was Arabs. We all know that's not it. But no, so there's that point of it. Two, so you're right in the one sense that the monarchy seems a bit anachronistic to our society to begin with. But at the same time, it is the foundation upon which all our democracies, all our parliamentary democracies, evolved out of constitutional democracy. I mean, France tried to jumpstart it, and France has gone through several republics, and they've never quite got it right. The United States is a corporocracy. So again, lacking that sort of foundational root, and even if it's only metaphoric, because the Queen, although has a lot of power technically, it's mostly figurative power, because if she ever tried to exercise it, there'd be quickly a revolution. But it does give you that sort of sense of stability and continence that goes on there. For example, when Stephen Harper closed down Parliament a year and a half ago, I believe, but he had to go to the Governor General, and it was a very long talk. And whether you agreed it was good that he did that or not, you at least felt that he wasn't being a complete dictator, that there was at least some minor check and balance that was going on before he could actually do all this. And as I say, although traditionally royalties are very despotic, very absolutist, that's not what we have right now.
No, it's not. But again, like, you know, people will go and look at that incident with the Governor General and point to that as one of the huge problems that we have. We've created a system of government that has a loophole that completely cuts out democracy. The Governor General can do whatever they want. And likewise, it's not really true that the Queen and the royal family doesn't really have any kind of authority. I believe it was a couple months ago we found out that Prince Charles has been lobbying Parliament in secret. And not only does he do that, he uses his wealth and his position to promote his ludicrous alt-med positions. He's, like, single-handedly almost destroyed the GM food industry in Europe. These people do have real power. And this notion that it is, you know, part and parcel of parliamentary democracy, well, you can make that argument. I think, though, just as likely, though, you know, France's system or even the American system, they all have their flaws. Our system has its flaws as well. And, you know, you have to deal with that through a democratic fashion. I don't think that the Queen or having a kind of figurehead monarch actually solves any of those problems.
Well, okay, so again, let's play upon Prince Charles, which I would agree does not represent the best in monarchy. But again, any rich individual has in our society an inordinate amount of power. I mean, I'd say they got the Koch brothers, they've got Murdoch, right, who are not royal, but are probably far more destructive to those cultures than Prince Charles is. And a lot of his power is based upon his wealth and his mother's wealth, right? I mean, he does gain half of it from his royal standing, but as I say, a lot of that is deference than it is actually we have to follow what you say. And to go on with the Queen herself, and you're right, I was listening today, I think it was, that people were talking about, you know, they're doing this wonderful celebration in honor of the 60 years of good service she has done to the nation. And that's important, good service. Now, if this had been Prince Charles was king and he was celebrating his diamond jubilee, not that he ever will, but if he was, as you mentioned, he's a nutter. They probably would not go all out for this. There may not even be anything other than a token ceremony. Or King Edward V, the Nazi.
Oh, the one who abdicated the throne.
Yeah, King George V. That was it, yeah. Who abdicated the throne. But, I mean, again, I mean, he was a Nazi, right? I mean, even if he managed to stay in power during the war and, you know, sort of said, well, I support him, but my country first, I guess. Again, you would not have had this sort of, you know, there is a good job and a bad job in this job. And
oh,
as
sure.
you point out, I mean, it's not exactly her fault that she's doing this job. I mean, she had as little choice doing it as herself, and she's trying to do a good job. And obviously, by the uproar of popular response, people agree. So it is perhaps anachronistic. Perhaps you're right.
Well, I'm skeptical that most people even support the monarchy. I've read a few articles that imply that that's actually not the case. It's just that major news outlets don't give them any time to demonstrate that they're not terribly happy with this sort of thing. And again, if you watch our local news, there is absolutely no coverage whatsoever of all the people who say, isn't this kind of ludicrous that we're celebrating somebody whose sole achievement was an accident of birth?
No, that's not their sole. As I mean, I just explained that there is more to it than just have been an accident of birth. You're right. I mean, the Diamond Jubilee in and of itself is, yes, accident to birth. But the celebration and the grandness of the celebration revolves around how good people perceive her doing that. Again, when Princess Di had died, the monarchy was really at a low point. You would not have had such a large celebration coming out at that time because it was not seen to have done that good of a job. So, I mean, I think it's a bit more than just it was an accident of birth. It's an accident of birth she got the job.
Mm-hmm.
But how well she's actually performed in that job, it's a bit more.
I would be skeptical that there isn't actually a job for her to perform at. But we need to be moving on anyway. We're going to be talking about snake handling, which is kind of related to what we were just talking about. But go ahead on the snake handling there, Don.
Prince Charles, you know, is going to come down here and he's going to hit you with his homeopathic weapons.
Yes, that'll be horrible.
So recently in the news, Pentecostal preacher Mark Randall Wardoff, who was one of the last great sort of serpent handling preachers in the U.S., passed away Sunday. By anyone, he was bitten by a snake. The Washington Post profiled Wolford last November, telling his of his ongoing faith in his ministry in spite of his own father's death of anyone, snake bite in 1983. The pastor promoted the event on his Facebook event, calling it a homecoming like the old days, the Holy Ghost filled, speaking in tongues, signs, believers. The practice of snake handling, or more specific, serpent handling, is a relatively new phenomenon. It has its origins about a century ago and hit its high point in the 1920s. One of the founder of it, essentially, was George Wendt Hesley, 1880 to 1895, who introduced the snake handling practice to the Church of God in Cleveland, Tennessee. I think Cleveland was in Ohio, but I guess there's more than one. He later resigned from his ministry and started the First Holiness Movement Church to require sort of snake handling as evidence of salvation. He also died. Anyone? Snake bite. There's a thread, I don't know if you've noticed, going through all this.
Mm-hmm.
The holiness movement itself has sort of two key beliefs. One, regeneration by grace through faith with the assurance of salvation, which is your standard born-again sort of this. But they also have another one where there's a sanctification by a second defined work of grace. This second defined work of grace refers to a personal experience subsequent to regeneration in which the believer is cleansed from the carnal nature. Usually this means that a born again sins again and then is saved again, and somehow in the second time around it makes it holier, purer, what have you. Snake handling itself is the Pentecostals claim is a practice used to sort of get closer to God and to test your faith. They're inspired by Mark 16, verse 17 to 18, which talks about the five signs of salvation. It reads, "And these signs will follow those who believe. In my name, they will cast out demons." We call it exorcism. "They will speak with tongues." I'm speaking in tongues. "They will take up serpents. And if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. And they will lay their hands on the sick and they will recover." Now, it's interesting to note that these are the King James Bible version of the text, which the Pentecostals at least believe, and the snake handlers believe, is the definitive word of God. So the earlier Bibles written by people who may have actually talked to God, if you believe that sort of thing, they got it wrong. It was King James. He was the one who was actually divinely inspired, not Jesus. So take that in mind. Now, of course, this means, as I mentioned before, besides snake handling, these groups also enjoy strychnine cocktails and other poisonous drinks. There are about 40 or so practicing churches in the United States with a few thousand followers. It's becoming more and more of a diminished sort of act. More people are taking it as interpretive or not literal. It's a sort of figurative speech. But there are actually a couple of churches apparently here in BC and Alberta that still follow this tradition. There are laws in some states that actually specifically forbid this, notably in the southern states. However, these laws are actually seldom enforced, and the practitioners can get around it by having services in their home. And because it's in their home, it's no longer sort of an official thing and it doesn't cover the law. So you sit back and say, okay, these people have wacky beliefs. All religious people have beliefs. But, I mean, maybe there's something to it. Because, I mean, you know, thousands of people handling poisonous snakes. Why aren't there, like, hundreds of deaths every week? Why haven't they driven themselves to extinction? Well, the snakes they tend to use are ones specifically kept for the service. Essentially, they're pets. And there are lots and lots of people who are pet owners who have very venomous, very poisonous snakes. And they manage to live if you handle it sort of in the right way. Snakes don't look at people and say, ah, there's a meal or anything. They usually say, hey, you might be threatening, But that diminishes as you become a pet. It becomes used to humans. It says humans aren't going to hurt me. So the real risk from these are pretty slim, and rarely does it happen. Again, it does happen, obviously, these people. In fact, one of the other negative effects, there was a law in Georgia that was passed in, I believe, the 1820s that actually set a death penalty for anyone who did this practice of snake handling that resulted in harm. And it was because there was a 7-year-old girl who had died from this from snake handling. So they had sued. But the jury refused to convict because they thought the sentence was too harsh. Hmm. So that was kind of weird. In fact, there's actually specific training you can get onto how to handle snakes. In fact, I tracked down one in Australia, which tells you how to handle snakes. And of course, they weren't doing it for religious reasons. There are a lot of poisonous snakes in Australia, so it's important for you to know how to handle it because some of them might slither into your bathroom or something and you need to get rid of them. Now, with regards to poisons, this actually I was quite surprised to find out. As it turns out, strychnine, which is one of the more popular ones they tend to use, in small doses is actually a stimulant and has been used as an enhancement by athletes. And we're not talking homeopathy. You need to have some of it in there. Strychnine actually made the headlines back in 1904 during the St. Louis Olympics. One athlete, Thomas Hicks, was about to give up while running on a marathon. He was given a pick-me-up by his trainer. There were no anti-drug laws at that time. You could have taken anything you wanted, and that was considered okay. The elixir the trainer gave him was a raw egg, some brandy, and a small dose of strychnine. Thomas finished the race in second place, and it only took four doctors to revive him after he crossed the finish line. In 1992, the first athlete to test positive for drugs at the Olympics was a Chinese athlete who took a natural pep capsule, and in the pep capsule was some strychnine. By the way, Thomas, who, as I said, finished second, ironically enough, actually won gold. Apparently, the first place winner also used a performance-enhancing drug called gasoline, delivered by the mechanism of car. Yeah, he was disqualified because apparently he drove part of the race, which
just... Figured a cheat, you know. Yeah. Cheat, right.
Now, these people who are true practitioners of this sort of belief, I mean, they believe it pretty hardcore. I found one website that was preaching this sort of snake handling sort of stuff. And they had said that people who do not do all these five signs, the ones I had mentioned earlier, they are counterfeit Christians. And you sit back and you go, well, wait a minute. But I mean, you know, nowhere in the Bible does it mention, you know, Jesus handling snakes. And you would have thought in early church texts they would have had, you know, Peter or one of the popes handling snakes. You know, I mean, they would have been close to them. They would have known what it was like. But of course, as these people do, they have an excuse for this. So, and they say, and I'm quoting from their website, some say that Jesus never handled poisonous snakes. Who cares? He said it. Jesus said it. That settles it. That's all that matters. Moses handled serpents. No doubt, Jesus probably did too. It just wasn't documented. You'd think that would have been something. I mean, if it was as important as these people are saying, and I mean, they're saying, if you do not do these five things, you are condemned forever to hell. I mean, it is a black and white sort of thing. And they take one passage out of one obscure sort of document, well, relatively speaking, and that's it. You're dead. Or, I guess, not alive forever.
Well, I mean, it's just as realistic as any other part of the Bible.
Yeah, no, with the one exception, and this is, I think, right up there with the Shakers, which was another religious sect, who didn't believe in having sex, even for procreation, that this is one of those sort of sects that does sort of self-limit itself because eventually they kill themselves off from snake bites. And then, yeah, so...
Well, then maybe we should put them in a museum or something, I guess.
or maybe we should pass a law based on this because, I mean, if you're going to go with religion all the way, you should go all the way, that anyone who attends church must first be willing to be bit by a snake. Actually, handle a snake. We'll be careful. But it's the drink poison. And no harm shall be done. I was reading an account that this particular pastor who died from a snake bite did this. He drank some strychnine and was for a week in... he spent like the whole night trying to recover from poisoning. And he was, you know, he couldn't breathe. He was having trouble breathing, doing the whole nine yards. And he was saying, oh, the devil was telling me to die, but I knew I could live. And I'm going, well, first of all, harm did come. We're in bed, you were barely breathing, you almost died. That strikes me as qualifying as some kind of harm.
Well, you know, I mean, his faith is being tested. So, and he persevered. So, ergo, something, something, God.
Yes.
Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker. And when we come back, we will discuss whether or not dogs can feel guilty, because I know that's what's on listeners' minds right now.
Yes.
Stay tuned, folks.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So the question on everybody's mind these days is, do dogs feel guilt?
Well, first of all, we should preface this by saying, do cats feel guilt? And I think anyone who's owned a cat knows the obvious answer is no. They may feel vengeance. I think they have a certain malicious tendency, but okay, guilt. But dogs obviously, because dogs are loving, caring, empathetic animals, right? I mean, they have to feel bad when they do something bad.
Well, that's a good question because, you know, as a dog owner, I have to admit that there are times when I think my dog is pondering deep philosophical questions about morality and whether or not, you know, she should eat that plant. The question is, does dog behavior imply that dogs feel emotions like guilt for, say, eating the plant, or remorse for disobeying me, or pride for, you know, not eating the plant? Or is this just learned behavior like the clever Hans effect? So this is what a group of canine cognition researchers, and no idea that such a thing exists, from the Idővas Loránd University in Budapest, led by Julie Heck, set out to investigate. And they reported in a paper in the Journal of Applied Animal Behavioral Science. So according to the researchers, 74% of dog owners believe that their dogs experience guilt. Now, emotions like guilt are called secondary emotions. They include things like jealousy and pride. And they are very rare in the animal kingdom. The argument usually given for this lack of evidence is that such secondary emotions seem to require a level of cognitive sophistication, particularly when it comes to self-awareness or self-consciousness. And there's lots of skepticism that exists in non-human animals. However, Charles Darwin observed that types of behaviors associated with guilt, like keeping one's head down, averting one's gaze, also seem to exist in social non-human primates. So this is not too surprising, because for humans, guilt serves to reinforce social relationships and to minimize the effects of transgressions against social norms and patterns. So for a social primate, you know, we could assume that could have an impact as well. We've also observed similar behavior in wolves as well as domesticated dogs. So in wolves, it's thought that the guilt-related behaviors serve to reinforce social bonds. And, you know, if dogs do it, well, humans are generally part of the dog's social circle, so maybe dogs do it as a way to, reinforce social bonds with humans. But That does not necessarily imply, though, that they have those secondary emotions, because if these guilty behaviors are about doing things that they feel guilty about, or they could just be, you know, a learned response to certain behavior. So given that owners tend to scold their dogs less if their dogs, quote, act guilty, the behavior may just be a response to the stimulus. So dog eats the plant, there's the impending punishment, and the dog learns that by doing these behavior cues, they will, you know, get less punishment or maybe escape punishment altogether. So it's not so different from the clever Hans effect, and that's, of course, named after the famous horse who relied on subtitle behavioral clues from his owner in order to succeed at mental arithmetic problems. So the researchers came up with an experiment to test this. They designed it to answer two questions. First, would dogs who have misbehaved in their owner's absence behave differently when greeted by their owners than dogs who did not misbehave? Second, would owners be able to determine upon entering a room and relying solely on the dog's greeting behavior whether or not their dogs had actually transgressed? So first, the researchers determined the baseline greeting behavior for each of 64 dogs when reunited with their owner after a brief separation. Then the researchers enforced a social rule that food placed on a table was for humans, not dogs. Then the dogs were left alone in the room with the food. Then researchers assessed how dogs greeted their owners after eating or not eating the food. In addition, they assessed whether the owners could determine whether or not the dog had transgressed and eaten the food. The first finding validated the notion that dogs don't always act guilty, only under certain circumstances. Dogs displayed significantly fewer guilt-related behaviors when being greeted by their owners compared with when they were scolded. However, what they discovered was that dogs who had misbehaved were not statistically likely to behave any differently than dogs who had not misbehaved. The next set of results are a bit confusing. Almost 75% of the owners were able to determine whether their dogs had misbehaved or not, which is significantly more than what you would expect from, you know, random guessing. However, the authors theorized that it might be because the owners are relying on their dog's prior behavior to determine whether the dog misbehaved. If they happen to know, for example, that their dog typically misbehaves, they're more likely to assume, well, my dog must have ate the food, and they were able to successfully predict they would eat the food in this particular case. So when they took this into account, it turns out that owners were no better than random guessing about whether their dogs ate the food. So I was reading some you know, articles about this report, and they pointed out a couple of flaws and, you know, some limitations. But it does lend some credence to the perception that guilt is more of a learned behavior in dogs. So acting guilty seems to lower the duration and severity of scolding, regardless of whether the dog actually did something wrong. And when they're scolded, they tend to act guilty anyway, which is because they've learned, if I do this, I'll get off a bit easier.
So there are a few things that I had found with this that I wasn't quite comfortable with. And to be fair, I haven't read the actual scientific article behind this. So some of these questions may be answered if you actually read the details. But with regards to the methodology, I mean, one, the interpretation of what is guilty behavior. I mean, what is guilty for a dog? Like, what is guilt behavior in a dog may not be the same guilt behavior in a human. So, like, the dog may be exhibiting huge signs of guilt, and all the other dogs know it, but us humans don't know that when he wags his tail in this particular way, that's guilty, as opposed to the normal way.
Right.
The other thing is there's the possibility that they were doing a bit of cherry-picking, that when the results didn't seem to agree with what they thought it should be, they went back and they said, oh, well, let's factor this in so we can get rid of the effect we didn't want. You know, so and actually it kind of goes counter to what you were just saying. So a dog that is prone to breaking rules gets scolded more, because it's breaking the rules, it gets scolded more, which you think would enhance its guilt ability, but you would also think it would be trained not to break the rules. I mean, that's sort of one of the, you know, when you train your dog, it does not do things. So you think, in an odd sort of way, the dogs that do break the rules more would in some ways, I don't know, be less likely to break the rules?
Well, again, not necessarily. I mean, if you have a young dog, for example, you can train them, I mean, all the time, but they're still going to misbehave. I mean, the thing with dogs, they go through this period where it's very hard to get through to them to not to do something. And it really doesn't matter what you do to them, they're still going to keep doing it until they reach a certain age when they can sort of figure out what you're saying to them. You know, no, don't do that, don't eat that plant, stay away from that, don't eat this, before that really starts to sink in. I mean, I think that one of the problems with this study, relating to what you were saying about, you know, what is guilty behavior, it's really sort of self-reported, because they ask the owners, what does your dog do when it feels guilty? And the owner says, well, my dog does X, right? But again, we can't go inside the head of the dog to figure out what it's really feeling.
Not yet.
Not yet. Maybe someday. But, I mean, we know that a lot of people will invest in their animals more than what they're capable of. And we learned about this when we talked about can animals talk and communicate. We know that human beings tend to assume that their animal, whether it's their pet or their, you know, research subject, they always think, well, my subject, my animal, my pet is special. It's really smart. We know for a fact humans do this, right? So it's probably easy for these owners to say, well, listen, you know, I don't know about other dogs. My dog Fluffy, oh, he feels guilty, very guilty, you know. And so when you're self-reporting data like this, it can be a bit messy, you know.
Does guilt cause gayness in... Sorry, you're getting very camp there. But but no, you're right. Because one of the things we've talked about on the show and many times is the idea of anthropomorphizing actually anything. It doesn't have to be your dog. That we attribute human characteristics and human traits to things, because for us to relate to the external world, it is easier for us if we assume on the other side is another human that thinks and acts like me. Mm-hmm. So we want to think that the dog thinks and acts like these. I think it's important, some other things too that was brought up about this, two minor things, is first of all the idea that secondary emotions, I think the term emotion is inappropriate in this sense, because secondary means you're thinking about it, which actually makes it a mental state. So it's actually guilty thoughts as opposed to emotions, because emotions are more instinctive. These are things that we would have even if we were sort of brain dead in some sense, right? Because they're derived from the body, in which case you would say that, well, okay, obviously dogs may not have the same kind of guilt we have because they have a very different sort of instinctual background. Another aspect that would play into this too is the idea of mirror neurons. And mirror neurons actually may make guilt more of a primary than a secondary emotion, because when we see something happen to someone else, i.e. they lost their cookies because someone else took them, of course that someone else was me, but we feel what they would feel. There's a part of the brain that actually sort of relives what other people are going through to a certain degree. And that may be, again, one of the areas where a dog may not, I mean, from a dog's point of view, and most animals that are semi-social. When you can get away with something, if you can mate with the pack leader's female, or if you can steal a little bit more food for yourself so you're a little bit stronger, evolutionary, that's an advantage, which actually would kind of push against guilt. As you mentioned, the more and more interdependent and more social your community is, the more that becomes a detriment to your genes overall. But I think, again, I don't think it's that big of a stretch to say that guilt is a learned sort of behavior. I mean, children are notorious for not having empathy or not having guilt at a very, very young age. I mean, there are some, like I said, I don't want to paint this brush too broadly. There are some aspects of it that I think are instinctual, but the vast majority of what we interpret as guilt is literally learned behavior. I mean, we feel guilty for a lot of things that if you sat back about it and you say, why should I feel guilt? I mean, we talked, I think, on the show before about something like masturbation. You feel guilt about it. Or playing games. Why should you feel guilty about playing a game? You only feel guilt because you've been taught that this is something you should not be doing. And mm-hmm. without that teaching, there would not have been guilt.
Well, I mean, there's a whole debate about learned versus innate behavior. I mean, we could take up the rest of the show in four more just discussing that whole discussion.
Okay, I brought my coffee.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could do that, but we really should air part three of our interview with Seth Klein at some point. In fact, why don't we go to a commercial break here, and when we come back, we'll have part three with Seth from the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives. Stay tuned for that here on CITR.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
So vote
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
In Canada, June is recognized as National Aboriginal History Month and culminates on June 21st, which is National Aboriginal Day. CITR is a proud supporter of National Aboriginal History Month and is pleased to bring you special programming as well as highlights of events taking place throughout the month of June.
On June 5th, come to the Victoria Theatre in the Irving K. Barber Library for the grand opening of National Aboriginal History Month. There you will find several visual displays dedicated to National Aboriginal History Month, as well as a screening of the film Musqueam Through Time and a discussion of Marple Village by Susan Roy, author of These Mysterious People.
Hello again, listeners, as we begin the last of a three-part series with Seth Klein. Seth Klein is director of Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives here in BC. He has graciously agreed to share his knowledge and opinion on a number of policy issues, such as austerity, taxation, and inequality in BC, Canada, and abroad. This week, we're going to focus in on inequality and its consequences for the economy and society. Hello again, Seth.
Hi.
We have discussed on our show a number of times inequality in the Occupy movement. Many people have commented that the Occupy movement or the 99% has no point. I think the point is the intersection of economics and political inequality. First, I have read that we have the most productive economy in history, Western society, that barring, of course, the slight downturn we've taken during this current recession, we make more stuff and there's more money out there than there ever has in history. Is this true?
Well, society, I think overall economies of wealth are growing. But if you look at economic performance, I would actually, I mean, there's no great mystery to this. If you were to look at the 30-year period after World War II, what you might call the Keynesian economic period, and compare it to the neoliberal economic period from the mid-70s to more recently, that earlier Keynesian period saw much, much stronger economic performance, but the gains of that were shared more equally.
Well, that leads into my next thing, because I've also read with regards to purchasing power that the 90% or the working class essentially have actually lost ground over the last 30 or 40 years. That for the first time in sort of the industrial age, that might be a bit broad, but the next generation will be worse off than the current generation.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. It doesn't quite work when you talk about the 90 or the 99%. The work that we've done over the years that in particular looks at families with children, that the bottom 40% of those families has actually seen a deterioration in their household income adjusted for inflation, even though those families are better educated and have dual earners compared to a generation earlier. So here you have families that are working smarter and working harder and falling further behind. With others, there is an increase in their absolute income, but even there, an explosion in inequality. So it's really only if you look back on the last 20 years, for example, it's only the richest 20% of Canadians who saw an increase in their share of overall income. Everybody else saw a decline. And you might say, well, oh, but that's only relative. Everyone, you know, a rising tide still lifts all boats. But those relative differences still make people worse off in significant ways. First of all, when you get particularly the wealthiest 1% pulling away from the pack, they're causing affordability problems for people down the income chain, if you will, particularly on the housing front. Their wealth is making housing costs more expensive for everybody. But we also know that more unequal societies, and this is, I'm drawing now on really the really important work of British epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, and their work in a book called The Spirit Level. The more inequality there is in a society, there's all kinds of social and health consequences and costs that are borne by everybody, ironically, even the 1%.
Although things may have increased to a certain degree, that not all economic levels have gained or suffered equally based on both the boom and the current recession/depression we're in right now.
Yeah. Well, you've always got to be careful with overall averages. They don't tell you very much. They're not particularly revealing. And certainly what we know in our own society is, again, you know, you might, let me just take, for example, the poorest 20%. So did they see an increase in their income over the last 20 years? Yes, they did, but it was tiny, you know, a couple $1,000s a year over 20 years. But if you looked at only the bottom 5%, you would find that their incomes have actually declined, the poorest 5%, because of minimum wages being frozen and welfare rates being frozen and things like that.
As our listeners know, I'm certainly no big fan of capitalism or its ugly offspring, corporatism. But the reality is we do live in a capitalist society. So isn't inequality a necessary part of capitalism?
There's always been inequality in capitalism, but not like this. And in fact, economic performance has been stronger when inequality was more contained. So, for example, if you compare, as Armin Yalnızyan has done, one of our national senior economists, if you look at something I mentioned earlier, a third of all income growth in the 10 years leading up to the recession went to the wealthiest 1%. Well, it didn't always used to be like that. If you look at the 1950s and 60s, when the economy was also growing very quickly, no one would argue that the economy wasn't well performing then, the richest 1% only took 8% of income growth. So there's certainly nothing inevitable about this. And there is a really interesting literature in economics that looks at the economic costs of inequality. First of all, there's a literature that looks at that at the firm level or the workplace level. And there's a literature in sociology or in organizational management that says the more unequal a workplace is, it undermines productivity. And similarly, you know, in the wake of the Occupy movement, you started to get economic warnings coming from some unlikely sources. It was coming up in Davos at the World Economic Forum. It was coming up from the governor of the Bank of Canada. It was coming up from the IMF. And in particular, what they were saying is there is evidence that more unequal societies have worse economic performance and more economic volatility than those societies that are more equal.
Okay, so inequality is there. But how does Canada rate with regards to other nations on inequality? For example, our Gini score. And for our listeners who don't know what the Gini score is, it's a measure of relative inequality within a nation. The lower the number, the more wealth is spread around. The higher the number, the more wealth is sort of concentrated. So I'm going to throw out some numbers here. You don't have to write them down, but you can check our website for the details. Our Gini score is 32 compared to the U.S., which is 41. South Africa is 67, highly inequality country. But other industrial nations like Germany is at 26. Sweden and Japan are at 25. The ratio of top 10% to bottom 10% of incomes in Canada is 9.2, again, compared to the U.S., which is 15.9, South Africa, 33, but other industrial nations, Germany is 6.9, Sweden 6.2, and Japan 4.5. Essentially, I think these numbers show that other industrial countries have managed to have thriving capitalist economies and yet substantially more equitable when it comes to realizing the gains from that. So how do you think about how Canada rates in the world?
Well, not well. That's the short answer. When you look at how we compare, we certainly rank above the OECD average in terms of those Gini scores that you just mentioned. In fact, so within all the OECD industrialized countries, Canada ranks poorly, about 24th out of 34 countries. And we used to be in the middle. We used to be at 14th. Now, is the United States more unequal? Yes. But we have nothing to be smug about there, because inequality has been growing more quickly in Canada than it has in the United States in recent years. And that's something that both the OECD and the Conference Board of Canada have noted.
You've kind of mentioned this already before, but let's just put it out there. So what does inequality mean to Canada, and how does it affect our country?
Well, yeah, I mean, in many respects, that this is really the crux of the matter, what you're now asking. Because there's no disputing the increase in inequality. The question is, does it matter and are there consequences? And I would argue it does matter for a whole bunch of reasons. It's bad for the economy, first of all. It's harmful to social cohesion. It leads to a whole host of health and social problems. And I would actually additionally say it's bad for the environment and for climate. And it's also bad for democracy. I've already touched on why it's bad for the economy. And I would mention again on the social and health side, the work of Richard Wilkinson. He's plotted all of these industrialized countries and their level of inequality against a whole host of social and health problems. Overall health, mental health, addiction, teenage pregnancy, homicide rates, and other forms of violence. Every one of those things, you see a strong correlation between the level of inequality in a society and all of these health and social issues that we all pay for. One of the things we do at the CCPA in our climate justice project is we're interested in the intersection between inequality and climate. And there, too, in work, original work that we've done, you see that GHG emissions are also closely tied to household income.
Just for our listeners, GHG, greenhouse gases.
Greenhouse gases. So in Canada, the wealthiest 20% of households have almost double the GHG emissions of the poorest 20% of households. You know, so the 1% are a climate problem on top of everything.
That's something I would not have necessarily thought of, but good point. Well, just to see if we can bring it right home. So is there any example you can give that would affect me? So if our listeners are out there and they're saying, inequality you've talked about, you know, it's this airy-fairy stuff out there, but they could look at their own life and say, right here, right now, I can see how inequality is somehow affecting my life. Is there any example?
Well, let me elaborate a little bit more on what I think is the real significance of the Wilkinson work I was mentioning. So, for example, he finds this correlation between inequality and poor health. But importantly, it's not just the poor health of the poor. It's the poor health of everyone, right through the income gradient, as we call it in economics, right? So, meaning, if you are a wealthier person in the United States versus a wealthier person in Denmark, which has low inequality, the wealthier in the U.S. are also worse off. It's not just the poor. Meaning, we're all paying for this.
With all that stress of worrying someone might mug you.
Well, I mean, there's the mugging thing, but it's interesting you use the word stress, because as Wilkinson tries to explain this, the connection between health and addiction and mental health and all of this stuff, he does feel like a lot of this is rooted in a kind of psychosocial stress, is the language he uses, and that more unequal societies have that, and it's bad for our collective health.
Just to take a bit more in a different direction slightly.
By the way, he says he has one other fascinating correlation, because when you're debating inequality with right-wingers or our friends at the Fraser Institute, they have another line, which is it doesn't matter because of income mobility, which is to say, yeah, we have lots of inequality, but people are changing it up all the time. The poor today will be rich tomorrow, and the rich today will be poor tomorrow, and so we don't need to worry.
I think the Republican had a great line for this. There is the well-off and the soon-to-be-well-off.
That's right. There you go. But here's what's interesting about Wilkinson's work as well, which is he also plots inequality against mobility, because there's this whole literature that's existed in many industrialized countries that try to track over time how the income of a father determines the income of a son. And what you find is that the more equal societies like Denmark and Norway also have more mobility. And the United States and the UK, in contrast, perform abysmally on mobility. And so Wilkinson and Pickett have this funny line, which is, if Americans really wanted to live the American dream of Horatio Alger, they should move to Denmark.
You know, it's funny, because I was having a discussion with a friend of mine kind of about, you know, well, it's an equal system and everyone has their fair chance. And I'm reminded, because it's been in the news, the G20 that we had in Toronto, and how you had the masses of people attempting to have their voices heard being clubbed down and arrested, while the elites of our country, the lobbyists, were inside the G20 having dinner and talking to the politicians about quote-unquote real Canadian problems. And it just seemed to be such an unequal dichotomy there.
Yeah, and actually what you're saying now relates to the final cost, if you will, that I was mentioning earlier, which is the cost of democracy. Yeah, that in a more unequal society, it perverts people's feeling, and often for good reason, that we all have equal say in determining our collective decisions. And that is corrosive.
I think we kind of start off, we were talking about the Occupy movement and the rising identity of the 98%, and granted those percentages are a bit misleading. But one of the biggest things I think that come out of the movement is the difference between political engagement and civic engagement, where political engagement is sort of mediated and dominated by the party structure, lobbyists, and entrenched power structure. But civic engagement is largely free of that. It's mediated between individual citizens at the local level. What do you think about civil action? I mean, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives seems to be attempt to bridge these sort of two forms of engagements. Do you see them as sort of two things that are sort of separate and distinct, or more points on a spectrum?
Well, I see them separate and complementary. And to choose between them is a false dichotomy. I mean, ultimately, we need both. If politics and if political change was just something that happened at the partisan and electoral level, very little would happen, you know. That it's that civic engagement that creates political space and changes political culture and shifts the realm of what's possible. Conversely, if you only had that and never had a way of giving those desires political expression, very little would change. It takes both.
I think I agree. And again, I would like to call out that I think the work that you're doing in Policy Alternatives provides a sort of a political, a legislative sort of structure for a lot of things that people on the street or the normal people have as sort of an inkling. They feel that something needs to be changed, but they're not quite sure how to articulate it in a way that government can actually grab it and run with it. And you kind of provide that sort of hands-on for government to actually say, this is how we can actually do what these people want.
You know, what you just said is very similar to how I describe our work. I mean, ours is a political cultural project. But I often describe the work that we do is to show people that their best values are still possible. You know, most Canadians and British Columbians actually have pretty good values, and they do have a desire that we to take better care of one another and to rise to the challenge of climate change. But we have it beat into us that those values aren't realistic or realizable. And so our job is to equip people with the facts and the figures and the analysis that they need to say that's not true. And to have the courage of their convictions to know that we can still achieve these things.
Well said. So what advice would you give to our listeners to keep informed and keep engaged in a civic society? I mean, one of the themes of our show is that in order to be a good skeptic is you need to be informed. You need to be educated about the thing you are talking about. How would you suggest, besides obviously visiting your websites, to do this? How do we get engaged?
Well, of course, they should join the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. And we're actually the only non-governmental think tank in the country whose single largest source of income is individuals. So we do rely upon that. But don't just join. Get on the email list and get all of our stuff as we're producing it and use it. Use it to engage your friends and your family and your coworkers in these discussions that we need to have about how we look after one another. I'm always heartened by the fact that people are wanting to be active citizens in that way. They do seek this information out. You know, the CCPA, we had over 2.1 million publications downloaded off our website last year. People hunger for that kind of information in order to have those conversations. And we just hope to amp that up.
Very, very well said. And of course, just on a parting note of mine, that's one of the things I find very discouraging about a modern society is we seem to be discouraged from engaging in our civic society and our political. It's more about hockey than it is about the pipeline in the north in BC.
Yes. And yet that desire is there. We just published a report on the pipeline a month or so ago, and within 2 weeks it had been downloaded 12,000 times. So, and I think the playoffs had already started. So there you go.
So there is hope out there after all. Thank you again for your insight and information regarding vote inequality. You've kind of given us a last message. Is there any last thing you'd like to say? This is the last time you're going to be on our show. Hopefully we'll be on again in the future. But
No, I think that about covers it.
I think so.
Thanks, Don.
You have yourself a very nice day, and thank you again for spending time with us at Radio Free Thinker.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
But
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks to Seth Klein for giving us his time.
It was a very, very interesting and informative interview.
It was. It was very good.
Yeah.
Well, we're actually running out of time here on the show today, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, why don't you get us started?
So I've got two this week. One kind of relates to what we were just talking about with Seth Klein, a renter's rights workshop, West End MLA Spencer Herbert, and the Tenants Resource and Advocacy Center is holding a forum to where they're going to explore your rights as a renter. It's going to be held at the Presbyterian Church. That's 1155 Thurlow Street this Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's free admission. My other highlight is the Periodic Table of Nonsense. Now, obviously, you know what that means just by the title of it, don't you? Yes.
Yes, of course.
Some person who has a thriving urge to make the world a better place and way too much time in their hands came up with the Periodic Table of Irrational Nonsense. It's a website. You can go to it. It's divided all sorts of woo and quackery stuff into different sort of areas. So you have sort of the Fruit Loop block, which is sort of like one part of the Periodic Table, the credulous block, the delusionary block, and it's got little write-ups about, you know, things like creationism, hedonism. What was a few of the weird ones in here? Well, aura, out-of-body experience. Oh, yeah, that was the... There's one about biipsium. What is that? Yeah. Legendary creatures that loiter around and hurt Aboriginal people, all sorts of... Oh, I didn't know that was a thing. And they have one whole special block, the lithonides ones, you know, the ones at the bottom of the table, specifically dedicated to quackery.
Hmm. Excellent. Very, very informative and amusing.
Yes.
My skeptical highlight is an event coming up by the BC Humanist Association. It's called the Issue with Induction. This is taking place Sunday, June 10th, 2012. It's at 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Oak Ridge Senior Center in Vancouver. And the description of the event is that BCHA board member McLean Edwards will be presenting a talk, The Issue with Induction, Why Science is Fundamentally Unreasonable but Still Practical. So it's all about the problem with induction, which was talked about by David Hume. It should be a very entertaining event. All are welcome to attend. There's beginning of the event, there'll be about a half hour of coffee, tea, and socialization. After that, they'll get on with the talk. So you can show up, you know, in that opening half hour anytime you like. And if you want to leave a donation for them, that's great. They'll have, you know, tea and cookies and all that wonderful stuff.
And if you want to practice for it, just remember, there is no causal reason for tomorrow to be at all. So although you may think tomorrow will show up and the sun will rise and all that, there is no necessity in that, at least from a philosophical standpoint and actually technically a physical standpoint. The arrow of time is arbitrary, and we have yet to figure out why the arrow seems to go in one way. As far as we know, when we wake up tomorrow, it will be yesterday.
Well, that would be great, because then it could be sunny and we could see the transit of Venus. Unfortunately, Vancouverites have been foiled by the weather obscuring this very rare celestial phenomenon. But of course, you can go online. I believe NASA and a number of other websites have got live streams that you can watch the transit of Venus. And you really should check it out, because you'll never see one like this again.
What?
Unless you live hundreds of years.
Well, actually, I think it's 150. I think it's like 2170 or something. The next one shows up. You know, actually, I suspect that this is actually some part of conspiracy. I think there are Venusians on the planet that don't want us to know that they're there. So they have specifically clouded over the entire planet. Well, I mean, from my standpoint, it's the entire planet. Just so that we can't see what they're up to.
Those sneaky Venetians.
Actually, but just because we're in the closing moments, some people say, well, besides the wow factor, what's the importance of the transit of Venus? And actually has some really, really important science involved in it. One, we have kind of explored Venus, not quite to death, but we know a lot of information about its atmosphere, about its planet and all that. But one of the things we get to test with it, and it's good to have empirical testing, is when the Venus goes across the sun, it dims the sun a little bit. And we're judging to see what we can learn from that and then correlate that with what we actually know is the case so that when we take that data and we apply it to looking for extrasolar planets, we can validate that when we see this little dip and we see these particular lines in the spectrum of these far distant solar events, we can say now with a lot more certainty that they actually do mean what we think they mean because we've tested it with our own particular Venus transit.
Absolutely, and I even saw a few articles today about drawing some transit of Venuses that happened, you know, before the invention of modern film. So if you feel like it, you can go back and look at what early astronomers saw when they transited Venus took place. So, you know, take some time, take a look at that, enjoy it, and
there's an excellent article with the Quirks and Quartz did about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Freethinker, so this is Ethan, your Freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning fire.